Good afternoon. You are in California Ballroom B, like boy, where a panel will be held in a few minutes. Before we begin, will you please take a moment and silence all electronic devices? Everybody take out your phone, set it to stun. Oh, sorry, that's the phaser. Star Trek days. And I see a few people have taken them out, some of you haven't. If your cell phone goes off during the presentation, it's mine. I made that up. Nobody believes me. That's fine. Welcome to the 54th birthday party of Overeaters Anonymous. Nancy, you okay that we start now? My name is Karen. I am a compulsive overeater. Hi, everybody. Let me do that again. I'm Karen. I'm a compulsive overeater. Oh, God love you all. And I'm your last-minute fill-in moderator for this panel. Once again, if you haven't already done so, please silence all electronic devices. Okay. For those of you who would like to, please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. I will not. Mine be done. In keeping with the birthday party theme of higher powered, the topic of this panel is Rule 62. Don't take yourself too damn seriously. The reference for that is page 149 of the AA 12 and 12. So if you want to place it in context, pull out your AA 12 and 12 and look on page 149. If you don't have an AA 12 and 12, there's a literature table in the room next door, and you can buy one. Hardback, softback, big and small. All these choices. Our speakers today are Michael B., Jennifer P., and Don P. Each will share their experience, strength, and hope for 15 minutes. After the speakers have shared, we will have 20 minutes for questions. A basket will circulate around the room while the speakers are sharing. If you wish to ask a question, please write it down and drop it in the basket. We will do our best to get through as many questions as possible. If you would like to direct your question to a specific speaker, please write their name along with your question. You will find paper and pencils in the basket that is being circulated. It's right over there now. You'll see the basket a number of times during the course of the speakers. We like to keep it going because maybe somebody will say something that triggers a question after the basket went past you, so just keep it going. If it stops, somebody's going to jump up and get it moving anyway. So, our first speaker is Michael B. from Los Angeles.
My name is Michael, and I am a compulsive overeater. And I want to thank Nancy for asking me to do this. And I want to thank everybody for being here. I just got here about 20 minutes ago, and there are a lot of people, faces that I recognize, and that makes me feel good, and a lot of people that I don't know. And if I am courageous enough, I will stick around and socialize a little bit. My abstinence date, is somebody timing me? Okay. Who is it? Okay. Can you, like, let me know when I got 5 minutes left? I have an abstinence date of July 20th, 1990. My sponsor is Terrell, and I... Wow. Don't take Terrell so seriously. My home group is the Kitchen Sink, which meets on Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock. And I have a commitment at that meeting. What am I doing now? I'm a greeter. That's a good commitment for someone who likes to isolate and eat pizza all the time. This is my second time around. I came to you in the early 80s. And I had a three-pack-a-day cigarette habit, and I was sober for about a year, and I started bitching about it in my AA meetings, and they didn't want to hear about it. They adhered to the traditions, which means in AA you talk about alcohol, And in OA, you talk about food. And, you know, they don't care if you're smoking three packs a day. So I got a little offended because I thought I could say anything at an AA meeting. And somebody told me there was a Smokers Anonymous meeting. And I think it's still around. It's called Nicotine Anonymous now. So I went to them. Primary purpose was to get rid of the smoking habit. And after about 6 weeks, the three-pack-a-day obsession was removed. And it was wonderful. It was miraculous because I couldn't do it myself. And shortly after, about 30 days after, I don't know why I had the willingness to get on a scale, but I was 30 pounds heavier. So I had gained 30 pounds in 30 days. And it was not the first time I had eaten compulsively, but it was the first time I was conscious of eating compulsively because, like I said, I was clean and sober as well. And I didn't like it. And so I went back to AA and I bitched about the Häagen-Dazs and the pizza and all the stuff that I was eating after the meetings. And they told me, no, don't talk about that here. But I knew there was Overeaters Anonymous, so I came to you guys. And sat in the back and I listened and I heard that a lot of you didn't eat sugar and three meals a day with nothing in between. And anyway, I'm giving a pitch a log, aren't I? And I'm supposed to talk about don't take yourself too seriously. So I just realized that. So let me get back on track. Matt M. actually 12-stepped me, and he was over 100 pounds. He had lost it, and he got me in the habit of committing my food and telling him the exact nature of my food, whether I ate it before, during, or after, and that got me on track. I got complacent. I stopped going to meetings. I stopped calling my sponsor consistently, and lo and behold, I went out again. And in 1990, I heard Dr. Paul speak, who is also in our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said that never in my 12 steps did I have a problem that did not offer me a solution within the 12 steps. And I was so far away from you guys at that time that it just felt wonderful to hear that. And I started calling him, and to make a long story short, he brought me back to the program. A day at a time, and it's easy. I had a slip in Alcoholics Anonymous, and if I drink, I'm not abstinent anymore, or if I take a pill or something like that. So when I came back, I joined a home group in AA that was very structured and very disciplined and believed in one sponsor, strong sponsorship. And when I started to gain weight again, I asked that strong sponsor if I could go back to Overeaters Anonymous. And he said, well, if you try every diet and it doesn't work, go ahead and go back. But I did that before, and I didn't want to do that again. And so I asked him if I could go back. He said, go ahead, kid. And then I knew I needed a sponsor, too, because in every 12-step program, for me, if I work it alone, I'm in trouble. So I asked my AA sponsor, can I get an OA sponsor? He said, go ahead. And so Richie was the victim of my abuse. And Richie took my phone calls for many, many years. And he really helped me work the steps and get back on track. Richie's still around. He's in North Carolina now, I think, and I talk to him periodically. And he would say to me things like, if I told him I was going to eat cheese, he'd say, why are you going to eat cheese? It's an artery clogger. And, you know, he put that foolish stuff in my mind. So now every once in a while, if I'm eating cheese, I hear artery cloggers. He also told me, you know, because I had a problem. A lot of people I heard from the podium, they get down on their knees and they pray. Now, I was born into a Jewish family, but we never practiced our religion. And so when I told Richie I had a problem getting down on my knees and praying, he said, since when have you ever been a practicing Jew? He said, get down on your knees. And so I got in the habit of getting down on my knees and praying. Now, I can't tell you to this day if my prayer ever reaches a power greater than myself, or I don't understand the meaning of my higher power, but I know that when I do it, I feel better. And my whole goal, I don't know about you, in this program, is to feel better. I mean, if I'm going to abstain and I'm going to consciously eat foods that are good for me, I don't want to be crazy behind it. And I can get crazy behind my healthy food choices, because I don't like to deal with life on life's terms. That's not my motivation. But if I consistently come to you guys and I consistently listen to you, and you guys have a higher power. You guys have some miraculous stories going on. I mean, my top weight, I was pushing 200 pounds. I think now I'm 160-something. So I'm certainly not a 100-pounder, but I've certainly gotten... I have one guy in the early 80s when I first came to you. He said, Michael, what are you doing in this program? What, you lose like 30 pounds? He said, I've lost more in one shitting than you've lost in your whole career in Overeaters Anonymous. And boy, that really made me feel a part of. But I got to tell you, I had heard that guy... Not only went out, I heard that guy passed away. So, and maybe from the disease, I don't know. I'd probably wish he would for hurting me like that. I don't like to admit that, but I'm pretty vindictive. But I've been with you guys for a while, and I think I'm too afraid to not be with you guys. I don't know how to live life on the natch. Let me tell you where God has taken me, where my higher power has taken me from. I'm a guy that does not like to work by nature. I would rather have someone take care of me. I just don't like to get up out of bed in the morning. I like to stay up late, and I like to sleep late. And I never had a full-time job until I was 43 years old. And they say you won't regret the past, nor do you wish to shut the door. I'm not necessarily proud of that, but I am proud because I'm 62 years old now. And like I say, I'm 23 years abstinent. And for 18 of those years, I've been fooling my employer. I have a pretty respectable career. And it was because of my sponsor, actually. I don't know about you guys, but if you're honest with your sponsor, a good sponsor, my sponsor wants a little bit more for me than I want for myself. And that's a good thing, but in a way it's a bad thing because they kind of make you face your fears. And I was afraid. I always considered myself an actor. In the old days, I would have this part-time job for 12 and a half years, actually. And I wouldn't commit to them full-time because I needed to have some time to go out and audition in case a part came my way. The only problem was I would leave at noon. I would leave my job at noon, and I wouldn't go to audition. I'd go to the beach because in order to audition, you have to have a tan to look good for an audition. So I spent a lot of time at the beach, and I never went on any auditions because I was afraid, because I didn't want to go on auditions, and it's a lot more comfortable to lay on the beach and to get a good tan. And I went to meetings and everything. I didn't have too strong of a sponsor at that time. So when I came back to you this time, my sponsor said, why don't you go back to the college that you went to 17 years prior and ask a counselor what it would be like to get a teaching credential? And I said, I don't think I want to be a teacher. I said, I think I'm an actor. And he said, it doesn't matter whether you want to teach, whether you want to act, whether you want to be a dentist. What matters is you go back and you investigate something that you left undone. And 17 years prior, I was in the middle of student teaching, and I just quit completely to go practice my disease. So he said, can you talk to a counselor? And I said, yeah, I can do that. So I went and I talked to a counselor. And sure enough, all those classes that I took 17 years prior applied to my credential. And all I would have had to do was to take maybe one or two more classes to actually get the credential. So that was a little appealing. So I took the one class, and one thing led to another, and I started to student teach. And one of the classes that I was student teaching at, they volunteered for a physically health-impaired class, little kids in wheelchairs and walkers. And my heart just melted. I fell in love with those kids. And long story short, I went on an interview, and they had a class like that was open. And I told them I had never taught before. I told them the truth, you know. And I said, I don't have a resume, but the class that I'm student teaching for, they wrote me letters. And these are the letters and little drawings. And Mr. Blanc, don't leave us. We love you. You're the best teacher we ever had. And I said, that's my resume. And they hired me. And they said, you can come, but you have to go back to school and get your special ed credential. And I didn't want to do that. But what I did is I took one class at a time in the evening. I had two kids at the time. So I was teaching in the day full time, and I was going to school one class at a time. I ended up having like a 3.8 grade point average, and I didn't cheat. And my old MO, I cheated myself through college, my way through college and high school, and I was just horrible, horrible self-esteem and just a big, big cheat. And I did it legitimately, and I got my special ed credential, and I taught that class for 11 years. And something came my way 8 years ago where you could teach theater arts to kids in elementary school. So now I'm teaching theater arts in elementary school. I teach 500 kids a week, teach a lot of kids. I don't think I'm teaching them theater arts, but I know I'm loving them, and I know I'm teaching them a lot of stuff about the program. And I know I think I'm making them feel okay about themselves. I certainly relate to how I felt when I was, you know, in elementary school, and I just try to nurture them and make them, you know, just try to love them. Richie would say, when I'd say, oh, the standards, and I don't think I'm adhering to this, and what, he'd say, just shut up, Michael, and love the kids. Love the kids. And so today I'm loving the kids, and I have a nice career. I have my son from a previous marriage blessed me with a grandbaby. He's 14 months old. I got three other children from a current marriage. I could go on and on, but my life has changed. But I'm still the fearful little punk that I was when I came to you. But I come to you anyway, and I take little baby, baby, baby steps. And God makes my life beautiful. He really does. And so anyway, I have 2 minutes left. An amends that I had to make was... I'm not going to get into it. If you ask questions, maybe it'll come up. I'm schwitzing right now. I'm sweating. I'm a little nervous, and I'm a little scattered, but I'm okay because I'm with you guys, and I'll end a little bit early. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Michael. Okay, I'm supposed to announce to please keep the Ask It basket circulating through the room. Also, we have people standing up in the back, so if you have a seat next to you, an empty seat next to you, would you raise your hand so people who want to sit can? Oh, look at all the empty seats. There you go, folks. If you want to sit, you can. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Jennifer from Torrance.
Hi, my name is Jennifer. I'm from Torrance. That sounds so silly. Which is the topic of our discussion today. Don't take ourselves too seriously. My name is Jennifer. I'm a compulsive overeater. And hasn't this been a great birthday party? I mean, it's so accommodating. They're bringing in chairs if they need more chairs. I think this is terrific. Okay, I was thinking about this topic, and I tend to be a person that has always seen the glass half full rather than half empty and have kind of a Pollyanna attitude, which is not always the best way to go through life because you're kind of, you know, la-la land. But I don't take myself too seriously. And I think that's, you know, it's helpful. I have been in Overeaters Anonymous. I've been abstaining, God willing. On February 8th, it'll be 23 years that I've been an abstaining member of this program. I don't do it perfectly, for sure. In my life, I've gained and lost 100 pounds 3 times. I don't suggest that to anybody that is sick. Any normie out there would say, how could that ever happen? How could anybody do that? I don't know. But we're compulsive overeaters, and we do. And we hear it in these rooms. I was listening to one of the speakers today, said she had gained 300 pounds 3 times. I mean, and I thought, geez, Louise, we are a sick lot, but we don't have to take ourselves too seriously. Except for the fact, on the flip side, this is a killing disease. And it truly is. My ex-husband died of this disease. We've all known people that have died of this disease. So, you know, we have to, sooner or later, take some responsibility for it. But one of the things that I was talking to a friend today at lunch, and she was saying, you know, what are you going to talk about? And I go, I don't know, because when you're on a panel or something like that, I don't really feel like telling my story because, you know, I'm kind of sick of it, actually. But anyway, what I thought I would share on the topic of don't taking yourself too seriously is I have gone back to I started a new job in September. Okay, I have been in the travel industry for 42 years. I started when I was six. And anybody knows, all business has been up and down and up and down, but the travel industry has really been chaotic. And after 9/11, it just, people weren't traveling, the airlines are, you know, and it, blah, 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 blah. So over my career in this industry, I was laid off several times. And one particular job was a company that handled, and I was their manager for 10 years. And they were a tour operator that dealt strictly in Tahiti, which was fabulous. And you go to Tahiti two or three times a year, and, you know, that's not a hard life to have, I got to tell you. And you think you're doing a good job. They're bought out by somebody else and blah, blah, blah. You know, before you know, you're out the door because basically you're not worth what they think that salary should be. Thank you for this program. I'd have resentments and blah, and I would write them down and so on and so forth. Okay, so fast forward. I find another job. I get laid off from that after 7 years, and I'm thinking, now I'm getting old. I am 67, and so I was 66 when I got laid off. And I'm like, who in the hell is going to hire me at my age in the travel industry, which is not hiring anyway? I go on credit, I think, but, you know, God is going to take care of this. I have a real strong belief in a higher power that things play out the way they're supposed to. I go on Craigslist, and I see this advertisement for a position in the old company that I used to work at. And I knew it was this company because nobody would have the criteria for they wanted an employee but this company. So I knew it was them. I shoot off an email to the HR gal. I said, you know, I'm interested in this job. I know it's a flunky job, but I don't need to be making a whole lot of money. I just need to supplement my income. She goes, well, if it's up to me, 2 minutes later I get an email back. I'd hire you on the spot. So bottom line is I get the job. This is an entry-level flunky job. And I'm just so thrilled with it because I've done the management crap. I know where everybody in this company is at, and all I have to do is just do a flunky job. Show up, punch a time clock, and it's great. So every Friday, they have a reservation. I mean, I am getting to a point here. They have a reservation manager to go over all the blah, 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 blah that the kids have to know. And I am like 100 years older than everybody else that's working in this place. And everybody's on their cell phones and what have you. And so I show up, and they call me JP because that was my name before. We go by initials. They go, hey, what's up, JP? When I walk in, I go, oh, hi, so-and-so, hi, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, in this reservation meeting, if they have somebody new, they would have them stand up and talk a little about themselves, okay? So, and this happens to be a company that now deals, besides Tahiti in the Pacific, they deal with Australia, they deal with New Zealand. So we have a lot of Aussies and Kiwis working for us because it really helps to have people know that part of the world. And so they get these kids that want to come in. And so they're like 18 to 20 years old. And so they've got all of these pictures, of course, because they're taking pictures on their phones and they're doing all these PowerPoint presentations of their life, such as it is, only 20 years old. And so I'm thinking, and next week we're going to hear from JP. I'm going, oh, they know who I am. Why do I have to do this? I'm thinking, okay, well, number one, I don't take pictures because I cut off heads, so I don't. And I'm going through my drawers at home thinking, I've got to put this PowerPoint presentation on me. I mean, I can stand up in an OA room and talk about me, but the company, I'm not going to talk about me. Anyway, so I start looking for pictures, something to make this PowerPoint presentation, and I come across my God box. And it had to be a God box from probably 15, 17, 18 years ago, maybe. I thought, oh, my God. So she said, I don't clean up my drawers much, I guess. I mean, I've actually moved several times and just taken the whole piece of furniture with me, drawers included. So I'm looking, and I thought, well, I sit down and I start reading this. And going, oh, God, I remember that. Oh, God, I remember that. This too shall pass. None of it, absolutely none of it in my God box was applicable to where I am today. It had all been solved, or it had all gone, whatever, it's gone. My point being, you know, when we're into the drama of our lives and the pain and the suffering and whatever, this too shall pass. So if we cannot take ourselves too seriously all the time, it will pass. And 9 chances out of 10, that issue I had with whichever was a boss or whatever, I am so glad it's no longer in my life. I've come out on the other side much happier, much more content. And so I think this is something that we need to remember. Everything will be solved, short of dying. Short of dying, everything is going to get resolved. I think we do the footwork, we turn the rest over. That's always been my philosophy in this program. If I'm not doing the footwork, if I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing, working the steps, then, you know, I get the results. But basically, if we just do what we need to do, and we hear this, and I've heard this several times today in different panels about God has done for me what I couldn't do for myself far better than I could possibly ever imagine. And right now I am in such gratitude because I never in a gazillion years would have thought I'd ever be back at this old company. And I didn't leave them hating them. It was a fun place. It still is a fun place to work. It's a great, interesting subject to be dealing with if you have to work. Lots of fun kids. Being around a lot of young people is really fun to be around. And I get so into the gratitude because I can sit back and I can do my work. And I'm not responsible for anything because I've been there, done that, and I don't have to do it anymore. And I guess part of that just comes with the philosophy and the attitude of not taking ourselves too seriously. And I hate to sound like an old fogey, but I really do think that it comes from just being on this planet for a while. If you've lived enough years, you realize things are sometimes just not that bloody important. Our health is important. That's about it. Our health, our relationships, our families. But stuff is just stuff, and having the best of everything is just, was very, very important when I was much younger. Yeah, now, I've got a community and a group of people in this fellowship that I wouldn't give up for anything. Because everybody here, whether I know you or not, know what I'm saying. But our particular topic, we're talking about don't take ourselves too seriously. So I do really want to kind of drive that home. If you are the type of person that is always seeing, poor me, the victim, the martyr, all of these very unattractive traits, think about it. And if you fit into that category, I don't want to sound like I'm preaching, but you don't have to be that way. This is not what program tells us to do. Program tells us to get out of ourselves, get out of our self-centeredness, which we all are, get out of, I am no longer the most important thing in the world, and just be of service to your fellows, to other compulsive overeaters, to your family. I'm taking a big book workshop on Tuesday night that we have in Westchester, and it's terrific. This is my second year to do it. And the first year around, we were talking about the fact that we're all so self-centered. And I thought, I'm not self-centered. After all, I am a very nice person. And so I this was like just 2 years ago, so this is like 20 years into the program, and I'm thinking, but I am a nice person. I don't think of myself all the time, and I don't think I'm all that self-centered, and I'm just not quite sure what she's talking about. And then I realized, oh, my God, when I was married, my ex-husband, bless his heart, who I think I totally passed away from this disease, so it is deadly, was adopted, and he felt very strongly about adopting. And when we were married, he made that very clear that when we started to think of having a family, he wanted to adopt. And I thought, and because I was the doormat and the people pleasers, sure. If I was honest with myself, deep down inside, I would have said, no, honey, I really want to have a child. I want to have the experience of being pregnant and having my own child, and then maybe we could adopt. But oh, no, I said, oh, sure, that sounds great. Well, how bloody self-centered can you be to lie about adopting a child when you really don't want to do it? To make somebody else happy. And that so hit home to me. I thought, oh my God, now I get it. Now I understand what we're talking about when we talk about being self-centered. So for all of us out here who sometimes are feeling self-centered, don't take it so seriously. I love this topic. It just makes me giggle because I am kind of silly to begin with. I like being silly and I like having fun and I like not being too serious all the time. And we have such a deadly disease that we deal with 24/7. In my case, I was the fat kid. I started gaining weight when I was probably about 3. So it's all I've ever known in my entire life. I've never known what a normal person would be like. I've never known what it felt like not to be into the food. And, you know, that's a pretty serious lifestyle to have. But don't take ourselves so seriously. Just follow the program, work the steps. It's gonna play out the way it's gonna play out. And I've seen such miracles in these rooms. And, you know, we've all seen the miracles in the rooms. And to think that we have got such a huge attendance at a birthday party, we're 54. Isn't that cool? That is just so neat. And we've got people from all over the world. We have a lady here from Australia. I think that's so cool to come to the birthday party. You know, when you don't know anybody. But you do. You do know people because we all are exactly the same regardless of how old we are, what we are, gay, straight, polka-dotted, whatever. We're all the same people because we've got this insidious disease that we just have an we just love food. You know, and hey, food's cool. So don't take it too seriously. Thanks.
Jennifer? Once again, we have people who are standing, so if you have an empty seat next to you, would you please raise your hand so people who want to sit down can? Lovely. Also, if your cell phone is on, don't forget to turn it off. Thank you much. The basket is great circulating through the room. Thank you so much for all your questions. We will now hear from Don P., who comes all the way from Los Angeles.
Thank you, and I also want to thank Nancy for asking me to speak, and my sponsor Michael for being the warm-up act. When I found out about this topic, I thought about some of the things I'd heard in program, and there were like 4 of them that came to mind that I wanted to mention that are sort of random, but the thing in common is that they all struck me as clever. One of them is the telephone is the same shape as a refrigerator handle. Another one was, if the food is calling you, it's because you're throwing your voice. Third one came from Irving, who was in program, who, giving a Lifeline pitch, said, in those days before the internet, Lifeline comes in a plain white envelope with nothing on it but your name, your address, and your weight. And my favorite was Murray, who was a wonderful member of the program. He was over 600 pounds, who unfortunately later passed away from the disease. But he told a story about sitting with his girlfriend. He was a guy in his 60s, and his girlfriend had just turned 60. And he said, I was sitting in this deli, and my girlfriend said, you keep looking at the girls over at the next counter. And are you thinking of trading me for those two 30-year-olds? He says, no. He said, I swear this is the truth. I was looking at their sandwiches. But what I think the topic really means to me, the idea of not taking it seriously, it had to do with, before I came to program, somewhere deep inside me, I had this real fear that I was always going to be a compulsive overeater, that there was no way out for me. My experience taught me that. Every time in my life that I tried to lose weight, and sometimes I could, I felt like a spring was winding up inside me. It got tighter and tighter, and then it ultimately exploded. And I would go out and binge, and I would eat and gain more weight than I'd lost in the diet. And this continued to stair-step my entire life. And every time I'd think I had it, everything I'd think I'd get it, I got to be able to do it. There's a gimmick. It was my own self-centeredness to think that my ego, if I just seriously get down and do this, and if I really manhandle it and work it, that I'll be able to figure it out. Because in other areas of my life, if I had a goal, all right, it's over there, I'm here, what are the steps between, how do I get there? And for the most part, in other areas, I was able to accomplish goals that I was serious about. But when it came to the food, I was absolutely and completely devastated. There was a little movie short called Godzilla versus Bambi. And if you haven't seen it, it's a picture of Bambi standing there as a cartoon character, and then this Godzilla foot crushes it, and it says the end. And that was me in the food. Every time I got in the arena with the food, it kicked my ass. And every time I'd sit there wondering what happened and why did it happen again this time. I don't remember a time in my life I wasn't a compulsive overeater. I have pictures of myself when I was about 4 years old and I was skinny and you could count my ribs, and I haven't seen them since. I have no memory of it. My memory is of being heavy. And I was so heavy as a child that people would, much heavier proportionally than I was as an adult, people on the street would turn and look at me. And it was, in my head, meant that I was still heavy even after program. And I, again, the sort of seriousness of it was that I thought, if I really admit in my deep heart that I'm going to try to do this and fail, then there's nothing left for me. And it was that sort of ego and that seriousness that kept me from ever walking into the rooms. When I finally got to the point to where I just hit a bottom, and I have a vivid memory of laying in bed and feeling this gigantic stomach and going, I give up. When I finally came to a program, and I got a sponsor, who I got very scientifically, he was the only one who came up to me and said, if you'd like to call me, here's my number. But we've been together, and if I stay abstinent another couple of weeks, I'll have 16 years for February 1. Trust me, the applause is for the program and for God, not for me, because on my own, I do not get there. And for Michael, of course, who has no issues with self-centeredness. But I remember saying to him when I was first starting, I said, you know, Michael, I'm kind of scared about the ninth step. I'm really worried about it. He says, you know, you're not on the first step. And I said, so I shouldn't worry about it? He said, well, you can if you want to. But he said, you know, why don't you just figure it out and when you get there? And the reality was, ninth step, for anybody who doesn't know, is when you make amends to people and go tell them how horrible you've been, and it didn't sound very appealing. But I thought, you know what, I have to trust that I'm going to get there, because when I got to program, I saw things I'd never seen anywhere else. I saw a lady named Natalie who had lost over 350 pounds and had it off for, at the time, for over 20 years. And it was extraordinary. I almost didn't get it, but I thought it's sort of like riding a bicycle when you start as a kid and you get on it and you fall over, but you look around and the kids in the neighborhood all zipping back and forth, so you go, okay, somebody can do it. If they can do it, I suppose it's doable. I can do it. And I just had to trust and let go of it. And it was when I got to the ninth step, I made this. I had went through this very fearful amends to my father, and went to see, lived in Dallas. I went to see him. And I made apologies for a letter I'd written to him in college that was rather mean. And he says in his Texas accent, well, Donald, one of the joys of old age is I have absolutely no recollection of what you're talking about. So the fears are mostly in my head. The fears are mostly in the anticipation. Very few fears that I have are because of something that's happening right that moment. It's usually worrying about something that's already happened or worrying about something that I think is going to happen. And if I stay centered, which the program helps me do, I can get it. What I got from program as a gift was a sort of a lifting of the seriousness. And it was a serenity on the inside that on the outside you probably wouldn't notice that much difference in me, but I felt it. It was a genuine letting go. I remember going up to get a 60-day chip at a meeting. And as I got up there, I realized something was missing that I hadn't thought about before. And what was missing was the spring winding up inside me whenever I lost weight. It was the first time in my entire life I had ever lost weight and not felt the spring tighten up. And I realized there's something very different going on here than has ever happened to me before. And as long as I do the deal, as long as I stay connected to program, as long as I call my sponsor, as long as I talk to sponsees, as long as I do some writing, very simple things, not even huge amounts of time, I get relief for the 24 hours that I do it. And it is for the next 24 hours. It doesn't matter how many years I have. If anything, that tends to make me arrogant, and it tends to make me cocky and think, hey, I got this. I can let up on the gas because I can do it a little easier. But the truth is that if I do that, my food gets heavier and I start to put on weight. Even today, that happens. It's an ongoing process. It's something that I need to do on a daily basis. I had a sponsee once who had a gift for analogies, and he had a great expression that I love. He said, I can't stay clean today on yesterday's shower. And it doesn't matter what I've done. It only matters what I'm going to do for the next 24 hours. It's sometimes only for the next 3 minutes if I'm really in a distress. It's just a matter of staying calm, taking a breath, relaxing about it, not taking it quite so seriously, not feeling like it's a crisis that's going to end the world. Very rarely is something like that truly happening, other than inside my head, where all kinds of weird things go on. But at least in terms of reality, I don't seem to have a problem with that. It's a very simple program. I went to an AA meeting with Michael, although I'm not an alcoholic, but this guy behind me says, kid, this is $1 million program. You get it a nickel at a time. And that to me seemed like a great sort of piece of advice, because my initial reaction was very self-centered. It was, how do I get in here? How quickly can I get everything, and how fast can I get out? By nature, I'm a graduator. By nature, I want to do things logically. By nature, I like to analyze and cut up and organize and figure out how everything works. The program, however, for me has been experiential, not logical. The logic of it doesn't make a lot of sense. I have to admit I'm powerless over food in order to have any kind of serenity or sanity around food. That doesn't make any sense to me, and yet it works. I see it working in other people. I heard an expression, you can't be too dumb for the program, but you can be too smart for it. And I can certainly turn things in circles with my brain. I can analyze and twist and argue and come up with all kinds of conclusions, and yet all it really does is create a defense. It just creates a barrier between me and the program. And my sense of what's right and is not very reliable. I have to get outside my head. I can't trust myself. It's dangerous territory. One of our fellows, John, has an expression, you can't fix a broken brain with a broken brain. And I find that to be true. I can't figure out how to do this by myself. If I had, I would have done it years ago. If I had, I wouldn't be here. The truth is that when I read the big book, and he talks about controlled drinking or just stop for a year, I know I can't do those things on my own with the food. It's to me been a wonderful journey in that respect. In terms of letting go, just in terms of trusting, in terms of putting my faith in something beyond myself, that's a great gift because I can actually take a deep breath and let it out slowly. And I can trust that things are going to be taken care of and that things are going to work for me. In that sense, anybody who's new, I encourage you to just keep coming back because we all have different experiences, and you will hear your story at some point if you haven't, probably from somebody very unlikely that you would not think to look at, because on the outside we look very different. And my initial response in coming in was how to separate. I don't relate to that, and I don't like this, that person's an idiot, and whatever my going on in my head. And I remember talking to Michael about 3 months into program. I said, the meetings are getting a lot better. And he said, well, the meetings really haven't changed much, but you're opening up. And he was right. I'll conclude a little bit early as well. I just want to say it's a wonderful journey, and I'll leave you with one of the great things that I heard in program, also a great source of serenity, and that is that God only gives you three answers: yes, yes, but not now, or no, I have something better for you. Thanks for letting me share.
Wow, aren't we lucky to have such wonderful speakers. Before we go to the questions, how about a round of applause for all three of them again? Fabulous. Okay, we've got some fabulous, fabulous questions. I'm not sure we're going to be able to get through them all, but here goes. This one is directed to anybody who wants to answer. How do you get in touch with your sense of humor, your funny side, your silly side, when you're angry, particularly at home with your kids and or spouse? And you have a microphone on the table you can pass back and forth to answer, and if you need to see the question again, here it is. Anybody would like to answer that?
Well, I'm an inveterate smart aleck, so that helps, with a somewhat sarcastic sense of humor. So I actually have to curb it in terms of my anger, because I can make rather cutting, sarcastic jokes. I mean, I actually find humor as a way of diffusing difficult situations. In terms of if the things are getting heated, I might make a joke that's somewhat appropriate to my, usually at my expense, to taking myself so seriously. And it oftentimes diffuses the situation.
I don't know. So I'm trying to think of something like creative and something funny, and it's not coming to me. But I know that we've started very inconsistently, but we started at the end of the day as a family to talk about a Yahoo, I call it, something that outstanding that happened during our day, and three gratefuls. And my kids are kind of into that a little bit when we do that. And that sort of just diffuses, it lets me, first of all, communicate with my kids, because so much of the time we're so busy and into our own mishigas. But that practice, when we do it consistently, and when I take the time to actually do that, just a Yahoo and three gratefuls, that something that happened during the day, it just feels good. It feels right. And but I can get angry real, because my kids don't do it my way, and my wife certainly doesn't do my way, and I'm just a control freak. But that Yahoo and grateful seems to work, three gratefuls.
I don't have kids.
Okay, so I go on to the next one. Believe me, we have plenty of questions here. What is the difference between taking the program seriously and not taking yourself too seriously? That's a tough one, huh?
Wow, that is a tough one. I think it's very important to take the program seriously, because, as I mentioned earlier, it's a deadly disease, and it's important. It's important, but when I guess maybe if we take it so seriously and we make a mistake, if we can't laugh at ourselves and look back and say, oh my God, why did, or even if you're speaking in a meeting and obviously you're driving home, you go, why in the F did I say that? And then laugh about it, because, hey, it's dumb ones. There's nothing you can do about it. You know, I think this disease so very often can be a disease of perfection, or we tend to be perfectionists. We like everything to go perfectly, and that's never, ever going to happen. And so if we can just, you know how important the program is to our lives, our sanity, and our health, versus we don't do it perfectly, therefore, you know, laugh at yourself sometimes, because we're really pretty darn funny, I think. We're very funny.
So I told you about the structured and disciplined group that I come from, and they taught me to take the program seriously. They taught me that when I'm representing the program that's saving my life, to put on a coat and tie, because I do that for a job interview, or I do it, you know, it's crazy, doesn't say that in the big book, but it gives me a little reverence and respect for the program that's saving my life. Taught me to get a commitment at a meeting, because if there's a Clipper game or a Laker game, who cares about the Lakers this year, but if there's a Clipper game or if there's something on TV, my head invariably, no matter how long I've been doing this, if I don't have a commitment at a meeting, I will talk myself out of going to the meeting. Commitments invariably get me to the meeting. I don't know why, but that's what works. Call my sponsor on a daily basis whether I need to or not, because my head tells me most of the time I don't need to. And then when the S hits the fan, I won't call. So those little things, those consistency, those structure, that discipline of working the program, hold me in good stead. Now, when I mess up and my sponsor catches me on something that I mess up and I have to tell a secret, I'm real good at beating myself up. And I got to tell you, my sponsor, in my perception, is good at beating me up as well. But I breathe and I pray, but I really adhere to the. I really take this program because I don't want to go out again. Those of you who've been in and out, it's nasty out there. It really is, and it's nasty in here. Even when I'm practicing a program, when I'm abstinent, I'm not eating the food, using the food to anesthetize myself, but I'm not working the steps. I get crazy really, really quick, and scared, and angry, and nuts.
Yeah, I think I have to take the program seriously or my food starts to creep or worse. That's kind of a given. That doesn't mean that I can do it without a lightness or a sense of humor or a sense of humility about who I am and not think that if I take myself seriously, I can get pompous or go to the other extreme and get incredibly judgmental and beat myself up. So it's important for me to stay somewhat neutral in that, but to work the program hard.
Okay, how do you not take yourself seriously when you make a mistake?
I think this comes with being a little older that, you know, nothing is that serious. No mistake is that important short of, you know, injuring somebody else. And the more mistakes you make and the more you learn from those mistakes, you realize that these are all life lessons that you have to go through. And again, if you can't soften yourself with a mistake, then there's too much perfectionism going. You cannot do it perfect. I screw up every day, all day long, and I think it's pretty funny.
I had a friend who said that's why pencils have erasers. We all make mistakes. There's no way to live your life without making a mistake. Even if you don't play the game, you're making a mistake at times. So it's just a part of life. And one of the great things I got out of program was just sort of the honesty about it. Because before program, I would shovel the mistakes under the carpet and try and blame them on somebody else. Now there's a very free of, oh, yeah, that was, I screwed that up, sorry. And I let it go. Big, big difference in my life.
I hate making mistakes. I'm pretty much fear-based. I'd rather stay in my comfort zone. And I just hate it. I know intellectually all the stuff that we tell ourselves, but I just hate it. I hate myself when I make mistakes. I was going to make amends without sponsor direction when I first came back to you guys. And I decided to quit. I was going to teach a seminar in San Diego. And I chickened out. And I told a couple of people about it, and they said, well, if you're not comfortable, just tell them you're not going to do it. Well, the lady who I was working for had to go to San Diego and teach the class, and it was very self-centered and wrong of me to do that. So when I came back, I decided to make amends. So I arranged to meet this lady at a coffee shop, and it turns out she went to the coffee shop, and I went to the wrong coffee shop. Okay, so I called her, and I said, well, where were you? And she said, well, where were you? And I said, oh, Jesus, I was at the wrong coffee shop. You know what? Can I be there in 5 minutes? Will you come back? And she says, you know what? She says, I got out of a sick bed to meet you, for Christ's sake. She said, are you in some kind of a 12-step program or something? And I said, yeah. And she said, you know what? I forgive you. Now leave me alone.
I've heard it said, you know, on the topic of don't take yourself too seriously. Truth is, none of us are going to get out of this alive anyway. All right. How can you humorously respond when someone complains?
I have a problem with whiners. I don't like to be around. I don't. I'm not around whiners a lot because I choose not to have whiners in my life. But now that I'm working in this job with all these young kids, you know, and they tend to whine a lot. And I'm listening to them, you know, bitch about work like I used to do, like we all did. You know, when you're a puppy dog in work and you're starting out your careers, you know, you find fault in everything. And I kind of take a step back and I really try to turn their conversation around and say, well, how would you change it? Or try and, you know, if you're going to whine, at least have a bloody solution to your whining. And so that's kind of how I handle it. I try not to, when somebody's complaining, you know, try and turn it around so that they realize that there's something that can be done about it. And, you know, complaining is not a tool.
I don't know that humor is always appropriate. I mean, when someone's complaining, it's mostly because they want to be heard. And one of the things that I found is really powerful is to let someone say what's bothering them and then repeat it back to them. And they almost visibly sigh when they say, ah, you understood me, you got it. And once they've gotten out of that sort of rage thing, then we can move to see if there's something we can do about it.
So my experience with this is, I told you about my strong sponsor. Not so much complains, but he's pretty harsh. He's pretty... And when I asked him to sponsor me, he said, I don't sponsor idiots. And I thought, and I don't know why it came, I said, well, in my case, would you make an exception? And that seemed to work pretty well. I've been with him for like 23 years. And then now he's not a compulsive eater, and I'd come to his office periodically, and first time I offered him, he offered me a piece of candy, and I said, is it sugar-free? And he said, you're going to die on skid row of alcoholism. What the hell do you care about sugar-free? What's wrong with you? And I thought, oh, Jesus. And the second time he offered me a piece of candy, I took it and I put it in my pocket so I would diffuse the anger. And the third time he asked me, I said, no, thank you. It takes me a while to learn, but there's a way to handle people that push my button.
I'm going to throw out two questions to you because they're both good questions, and answer which one you want. This one is directed to each panel member. What do you do daily or minute by minute to do that, to not take yourself too seriously? And if you can, please be practical, give practical examples. And if you have trouble coming up with an answer to that one, do you think taking yourself less seriously is a key to getting and maintaining recovery?
I think not taking yourself too seriously is very helpful to your recovery. Some people have a sense of humor and some people don't. And you all know them. You all know people that you can say something to that is, you gotta know it's funny. And it's just like... And just kick up, make me giggle anyway. But, you know, some people don't see the funny side of things. And that's just who they are. But they can be lovely, wonderful people in your life. They just don't have a sense of humor. If you're blessed to have a good sense of humor, I think it helps you get through life. Because if we can't laugh at ourselves, you know, it's pretty darn pretty dull, I think. Anyway.
So my experience with this is, you know, I've been doing this for a while. And outreach calls are a blessing to me, and they're really a great tool, and it, at the very least, it allows me not to to get out of myself and to actually, even sometimes I have to simulate interest, you know, but at least, you know, there's somebody else on the other line. And because I've been doing this for a while, I am blessed. I get my first call at 10 after 5, and I have little, you know, books, 24 hours a day books, and we go over that and stuff. Then when I'm on the road to work, I get a couple of calls as well. Then after school, I get a couple of calls as well. Then after meetings, before bed, I get a call. So I'm really, really, my God, is like all over the place. So if you keep doing this a little bit at a time, a year at a time, you'll see that God sort of protects you. So outreach calls and literature and, you know, thanking God for my abstinence and thanking God for another day, even though I don't mean it in the morning. because I don't want to get out of bed. I really don't. And I'm talking to the guys and stuff, and I thank them for getting me out of bed, sponsor, committing my food, all that good stuff. See me after the meeting. I got a ton of them.
I think one of the most powerful things I've gotten out of program came out of the fourth step, which is where you make a column and you go through all of your complaints and problems, and then it says, what was your role in it? And I found that when I looked at my role and whatever the problem was, that I couldn't get as angry about it. And I think that's an aspect of not taking myself so seriously and feeling so righteously indignant when something's wrong. Most of the time, I find that if I put myself in the other person's shoes, I may have very well done what they did. And that even if I wouldn't have, I can see that something that I did caused them to do what they did. And it's much harder for me to feel as stressed or angry about it if I know that, you know, they're acting rationally and I may have contributed to it.
Okay, this one isn't exactly on Rule 62, but it's a good question. Well, they're all good questions. How do you let go and let God when you really want your way? I'm sure nobody has any experience with that in this room.
I try and pray for God, what is your will for me? Even though I know how I want it to play out, I always couch it. Even though I know God, my God, knows what's going on in my brain, too, and knows that I'm couching it the way I'm couching it. But in essence, you know, what is your will? And make it clear to me. You know, I pray to God not to have bricks fall on my head, you know. I pray to God to have those gentle nudges so that I am not caught with some horrible catastrophe. And then I pray to God to, when you give me those gentle nudges, make me realize that it's a gentle nudge, because I can let that go too. I when I first started in program, I hear people say, I get down on my knees. I have no problem with that, but your God, let, you know, this is not part of my morning routine to get down on my knees. So I'm more than happy to get down on my knees, but will you please put that in my brain when I wake up to get down on my knees, and then I'll do it. And I'll be damned if that didn't happen the next day and every day thereafter until my knees gave out.
So usually it's a small baby step that I have to take. Like I said, I have a hard time getting out of bed. After I talk to the guys, I want to still stay in bed. But I ask God to let me see the next indicated event, and it's getting in the shower. You know, and each next indicated event gets a little bit easier and a little bit easier. Tonight, if my son left me a message, he's going to take a cake, this is in another program, for 7 years, and he wants me to give him the cake if his job lets out, you know, at a certain time. And my kids usually show up, and they get dressed up, and it's a family night. But my 17-year-old said, well, Dad, I might have something else to do. And normally I'd go, well, you know, what's important? You know, your brother's cake, and you can do the other. And I said, enjoy it. I told her no. I said, you do what you need to do. And that's really different. That's a God shot from me. And I really mean it. It's what's important to me is not necessarily important to my wife, my kids, and stuff. So that was enough for me. I want to share this real quick. I write down affirmations in my phone, and because they're really available, readily available. It says, when I am aware of a character defect, I am not proving sickness. So many times when I see myself, I'm proving sickness and I'm beating myself up. It says, I am showing a willingness to face reality, which is what this program is all about, and a readiness to choose health. And a readiness to choose health. So stop beating yourself up. See what's there, the reality, and take a little step to choose health.
My mother, who was very spiritual, used to say, if you're trying too hard to do something and you're not getting it, then it's not right for you. And she also used to say, God never lets you make a mistake. So I can't tell you how many times in my life when I've wanted something desperately, not gotten it, and found out at a later point, sometimes years later, why something much better wouldn't have happened had I gotten what I originally wanted. And while it isn't always terribly comforting at the time I'm going through something of a disappointment, it is somewhat comforting. And look, there are times that are difficult and I don't get things that I want and I'm disappointed. But if I keep a bigger view of it, if I turn it over and sort of take a breath and understand it's part of a bigger scheme that I don't necessarily see, then I can get some peace around it.
Okay, I don't know if any of you have experience with this. Forgive me if you mentioned it or didn't mention it in your share. Sometimes I zoned out a little bit. But the question is, if you've had this experience, how do you live down gaining weight after losing weight in program?
Just keep going forward. You know, it's a hard, you know, the food is a hard thing. And I there's all different kinds of philosophies on this. I tend to believe that you can be abstinent and gain weight. You're just eating more than what your body needs to maintain a healthy weight, but you're not compulsively overeating. That's my story, and it's just something I struggle with on a daily basis. It's really, 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 I gotta tell you, it's very annoying. Very annoying. It would be so wonderful if you could just lose your weight and you would be done. We wouldn't have an Overeaters Anonymous then.
I like In-N-Out burgers, and I was committing my food to Terrell on a daily basis, and I was eating a lot of In-N-Out burgers, protein style, telling him to cut the bread, and I figured it was healthy because, you know, lettuce is healthy. But I was at In-N-Out a lot, and so when I went to the doctor, my cholesterol went up to like 250. That's high, and then I wasn't getting on the scale, and then I got on the scale and I was 184. You know, and when I came to you guys originally, I went down to 158 or something like that. So I called Richie in North Carolina, and he said, you know what, In-N-Out burgers every day, you know, what is this? You know, change your diet a little bit and get more exercise. And so I adhered to his suggestion. And so now I haven't had a hamburger in a long time. I'm actually hungry for one right now. I don't know what I'm talking about. But what I did is they have veggie cheese, you know, and I started eating a lot more fruit, a lot more vegetables. 4 to 7 times a week is what Richie said for the cardio, to exercise 4 to 7 times a week. That's in my head. That's what I try to do. Now, I just went to the doctor, and my cholesterol is 182. When I was adhering to Richie's advice a few years ago, it went down to 150. So it's creeping up a little bit because those little lean turkey pastrami and stuff like that are kind of inching their way back. So maintain my honesty and look at reality and not beat myself up and choose. Maybe tomorrow I'll eat that veggie cheese instead of that lean pastrami that is creeping back into my diet. And, yeah, so I gained weight, but I lost it, and I still consider myself abstinent and try to honor my humanness.
Okay, what do you do to lighten up? What tool do you use? Phone, play, gardening, or what? How do you lighten up? Do you lighten up? That wasn't on there, but, you know. And if you don't have an answer, believe me, we got a bunch of questions.
Wow, I'm usually always pretty light. Well, lightened up, if that's correct grammar. Thank you, God. I don't have yet in my life a depressive side. I don't go down that road. I'm very grateful for that because some people have problems with that. I tend to see things funny. I mean, I see the funny in just about everything. I was at a restaurant once, and with my family, and and the waiter, and it was one of these restaurants that had, I mean, they would bring a glass of water that were 3 times the size, huge, and he had a platter on about 5 of them, and he happened to just trip and he dumped the whole thing down my back, and all I could do was laugh because it was pretty bloody funny. And this idiot, you know, you think he could at least could have apologized, which he did not do. But to me, I just, it's much easier to look at that. So I don't have too much problem. And if I do ever get where I'm feeling sorry for myself, which that can happen a lot, somebody said in program, I adhere to this 100%, you're only allowed 15 minutes on the pity pot a week. A week. That's not very long. So if you've used it up, you've got to wait till next Saturday.
I think I kind of depend on people around me. I need to be honest about what's going on in my life, or my wife will often figure out that I'm in this place before I know I'm there, and I depend on her to let me know. I think just being aware of it and stepping back from it a bit gives me a perspective and allows me to get out of it.
Okay, that is all the time that we have. And if you want to hear Michael's answer, and I'm sure you do, come up to him afterwards and he'll tell you exactly his response. Thank you, everybody. Please help me thank Michael and Jennifer and Don, who are fabulous, for sharing their experience, strength, and hope with us. For those of you, I'm sorry we didn't get to every question. I will say there was one that asked, do you have some words on how to avoid a relapse? There's a recovery from relapse workshop tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, so if you're still in the room, whoever wrote the question, I encourage you to go there. After a moment of silence, please stand where you are and join hands as we say the Serenity Prayer, and I will knock after that moment of silence. The other thing I will say is after we say the Serenity Prayer, we're going to step away from the stage so that if the crew have to come in and start moving things around, they can do that. So we're going to step that away. And let's all join hands, standing where you are. I don't know that they're going to try to get us into a circle because there's too many of us. What's that? God.
Thank you.